This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to a new episode in the New Books in Gender Studies podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Kyle McMillan, and today I have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Marsha Morgan, talking about her new book, Black Women, Prison Employees, The Intersectionality of Gender and Race. Dr. Morgan, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you.
And thanks for joining us today. And I kind of want to start out by talking a little bit about your academic background and why did you come to write this book in particular about prison employees?
Well, my background's not really a traditional background. I'd completed an undergraduate degree many years ago, went on to do a postgraduate in education, specifically around offender learning. That was my introduction to prison work. And then after completing my master's, which looks at education and leadership in prisons, I then decided to complete a PhD, really out of frustration, if I'm honest. At the time, I was working for Her Majesty's Prison and Probation Service. I was going through a particularly difficult time. I was feeling very isolated. And while I was completing my master's degree, in which I was looking at race relations within the organization, I realized that there were no books that actually reflected the experiences of Black women. There were quite a few books at that time that was looking at occupational work in prisons, but it tended to be from the perspective of white male prison officers. There was just nothing that actually spoke to my experience of being a Black female working in a white male dominated organization. So that was really the catalyst as to why I then decided to complete a PhD. I completed my PhD through the distance learning route as opposed to the full-time route. And I also decided that I didn't want to do my PhD through a continuous professional development route because I wanted to have the autonomy to focus on Black women. And at that time, when I was coming against some resistance about my methodology and my choice to focus on Black women as opposed to doing a comparative study, I felt it was best to identify a supervisor that looked like me, had completed similar work in my field, and also a university that was open to focusing on a new area of occupation within prisons.
Yeah, and I think, you know, part of what makes your book really interesting when I was reading it is that it seemed so novel, right? That sort of frustration that you were feeling of not having this work available. And because it was certainly a new topic area for me to explore as well. And a part of what you start out the book talking about is sort of things that play into the prison environment or prison culture more generally. So how do race and masculinity, which are two things that you've already sort of mentioned, interact with the prison environment?
Well, what I found through the course of my study was that prisons have a very unique environment in regards to they are very masculinized. The majority of staff are white men and the majority of prisoners are male. There is an overrepresentation of Black and ethnic minority prisoners within the UK system, but this is not reflected in the staff cohort. What happens is, from previous studies and from my own study, I found that when you mix a particular structure, such as prisons, which is a controlling environment, which aims out to homogenize everyone in order to be a single type of person, when you have a Black woman who shares neither gender nor race with the dominant group, it disrupts the dynamics within the organization. And it disrupts the culture, it disrupts the way in which people relate to each other. And that tends to get played out in the interactions between those women who are marginalized because of gender and race, and also within the practices that occur. So what you will see through the journey of the book is that I provide an account of different structures within the organization are actually set up to protect against difference, whether that's gender or racial difference, because anything that is different or is unique is perceived as a threat within an organization that has very rigid structures.
Yeah, and part of what you also examine too is sort of the psychodynamic aspect of prison culture, prison life. So for those folks that maybe aren't familiar with that particular approach, what is sort of that psychodynamic approach, and why were you drawn to that in this particular study?
Well, an organization psychodynamic approach comes from the theory of object relations, which is Melanie Klein's work. The reason that I was drawn to that particular theory, it wasn't at the start of my research that I came across that. It was because from the accounts that I was receiving from the participants, I found that they were talking about experiences that were sometimes felt, that were sometimes or could be perceived as in the mind of the individual. That subtle type of feelings that people feel, whether that's through microaggressions or the way in which someone may speak or look. And also, at the beginning of my research, when I applied to the National Research Committee for the Prison Service to undertake my research, they were very against or resistant to me focusing on Black women's experience. They wanted me to complete a comparative study. And again, what you will see in the UK, and specifically in prison occupational research, it tends to focus, if you're looking at race or gender issues, it tends to take a more of a comparative approach as opposed to focusing on one particular cohort. The only time you actually see that is when the portrayal of white male prison officer experience is projected. So from the very onset, there was something going on that I wasn't quite sure what it was. It was also similar to my experience of not quite understanding why I was feeling racially isolated, that I needed to find a theory that actually spoke to that. And organizational psychodynamics speaks to that because it actually talks about the unconscious side, the things that you can't, the intangible things that you're not quite sure about, but it's happening. So in the chapters, you will see where, for example, the chapter around culture that looks at violence, mistrust and suspicion, you'll see in that chapter that they're not very specific, hardcore things, but they're the sort of subtle feelings that people get that that you're not quite sure about. That's what organizational psychodynamics looks at, the sort of unconscious aspects of the relationship that individuals have with their environment that they're working with, and also their internal feelings towards different things that may happen to them.
Yeah, and one of the more interesting lines that stuck out to me when you were talking about this approach and sort of the ways in which, you know, the affect or, you know, can affect sort of the day-to-day goings on of these prison employees, is you you make the point that prisons become or are organizations in the minds of the employees. So what does that mean? And, you know, why did you find that to be the case?
Well, when I use the term organization in the mind, I'm referring to the way prisons are made up of people. You have two distinct groups. You have the in regards to staff groups, you have the operational side, and they're the staff that wear the uniforms. And then you have the non-operational side. They're the individuals that do, like, for example, staff that work in healthcare or deliver education or are very specialist roles. So you have two distinct groups within prisons. You then also have multiple tasks of prisons. So prisons, if we look at the mission statement, is to protect the public, is to punish offenders, and it's to rehabilitate them in order to return back into the community. There again, you've got three specific tasks within one organization, in which you have different staff fulfilling those roles. Now, individuals enter prisons with various mindsets. So, for example, in the book, I talk about the fact that Black women have a particular role in society as Black women who are there to nurture and protect and look after the family and the Black community. Then they go into an organization that has a reputation for being institutionally racist, very patriarchal in the respect in which it's male dominated. So within that context, you've got Black women who, as I mentioned, share neither gender or race with the dominant group. They are they have a particular view of the organization. So my cohort of individuals, the majority of them were working in non-operational roles. There were some prison officers, there were some senior prison officers, and there were some in managerial roles, but they all had experienced gender and racial discrimination within the organization. They all had particular views of their role within the organization. So they talked about wanting to rehabilitate offenders, wanting to change people's lives, wanting to make a positive impact. If you look at the prison itself, the prisons have particular structures, which on the one hand is set to control prisoners, but on the other hand is set to rehabilitate them through education and training. And that causes tension and conflict. And that's what I talk about with organization in the mind, because the mission statement may say one thing. The staff that may go into the organization, so for example, those who want to educate prisoners, for example, will be going in there wanting to deliver courses, enrichment programs, but the actual procedure in prison might reduce or prevent them from having to do that, because prisoners have to follow particular structures within the day. They wake up at the same time, they go to the same workplaces, they return back to their cells. So it's very ordered and structured, which doesn't necessarily fit into that creative way of working if you're thinking about education. So if you enter an organization with a particular mindset that you want to do one thing, and the structure of the organization prevents it, then you then will have a particular relationship or a tension between yourself, your role, and the actual organization itself.
Yeah. So, and you already mentioned sort of the three, aspects of prison culture that sort of stood out to you, or I guess a better way to say that would be the three sort of main attributes that made up prison culture, these ideas of mistrust, suspicion, and violence. So how does it happen that these are sort of the main culture drivers within that organization? And, you know, what is then sort of the overall picture of the culture within a prison?
As you can imagine, when you're interviewing a lot of individuals, there will be a lot of rich, and it was a qualitative approach that I took, in which I interviewed 17 women. So there was a lot of different aspects of prison culture and experiences that came out in that data. But what stood out, and why I have a chapter that focuses on this particular aspect of prison culture, which is mistrust, suspicion, and violence, is because in the other chapters, there's sort of a thread that goes through there. So within prisons, in this particular chapter, prisons are, as I mentioned, are organizations that are set up to do a particular role in society. if you look at how prisons are built and what they look like, if you take the old Victorian prisons, there's a, in the UK, they're built in a particular way in which there's a central area in which an officer can then observe and watch all the prisoners. So straight away, there's that sense of being watched. In, you have to watch someone because you have to make sure you're aware of what they're doing. So straight away, you've got that suspicion element because you're not quite sure how someone might behave. That plays out in the relationships between staff. So prisoners generally will have staff who have worked in the organisation for many years, their partners, their children, or ex-military staff may work in particular prisons. And then you may have new staff that enter prisons. So, for example, it was only until the late 90s that you saw an influx of women working in British prisons. Before that, they were few and far between, tending to work in female prisons. Now you've got male and female prison officers working in all types of prisons. Likewise, you have, yes, Black women are the smallest group of staff. They make less than 2,000 out of a staff group of 40,000. So again, that's a new type of individuals working in an organization that has very structured and rigid systems and processes that have been embedded for centuries. And when they enter in the organization as being gendered and racialized subjects, they change that. So now they are challenging not just the gender aspect of prisons, but they're also challenging the racial aspects, because beforehand you had white male prison officers and female prison officers and staff managing Black prisoners. Now you have Black female members of staff as part of your group. If you're not used to engaging with someone from a different ethnic group to yourself in your personal life, then it will be very difficult for you to engage in a positive relationship in the work life. That gets played out in prisons, where you have that superiority role over prisoners. You have that in the hierarchy of the structure. So you have prison officers and senior prison officers. So all that gets played out in their everyday tasks. So if you compound that with racial difference, gender difference, the multiple tasks, it does cause a lot of anxiety amongst individuals and for the organization itself, which is set up to control and dominate those that enter the organization.
Yeah, and I think because your work centers, like you said, on Black women's experience in this role, I think we should turn to that direction. So overall, what does your work tell us about the experience of Black women employees in the British prison system?
Well, what it tells us is that where we've seen studies in the past that look at race relations within prisons, it's tended to focus, and we're looking at staff groups, it doesn't differentiate between the experience of, for example, Black men and white men as employees. Likewise, when we've looked at studies that look at gender issues in prisons, it doesn't tell us the experience of white women and Black women. All these experiences are very different. So what this study shows is that it's important to take an intersection approach towards the information that's being gathered and to the actual method in which you're collecting that information. Because what my book shows is that Black women have a very unique experience, which is based on their gendered racialization. The fact that they are members of two marginalized groups within this particular organization and within other white male dominated organizations as well, means that they have a particular standpoint that will be different from other groups. So this book emphasizes the fact that actually we need to be aware of people's multiple identities, especially along gender and racial lines. The book also brings to the forefront that prisons are very unique places and they are quite complex. What a lot of prison occupational literature tells us is that prisons are places where people go to work. What this book shows us is that prisons are also places that are in that people not just only work and not only interact, but it actually affects them as individuals. They go through a transition process of being not just entering a new organization and working there, but actually becoming part of that organization. Hence the reason why you have the organization, the mind aspect of it. what the book also shows us is that there are particular structures that are embedded in prisons that are difficult to break down, because those structures are there for a reason. They're there to protect the organization against the anxiety of having to manage different types of people, whether that's through staff now or prisoners that need to actually control and dominate, because prisons function on that very premise, to control people that enter the organization. And when you've got people that disrupt those structures, the organization will ultimately try to protect itself from that. And that's why when, for example, there are issues around the overuse of control and restraint on Black and ethnic minority prisoners, and the and then you have the organization which will then do investigations into those incidents. So in effect, it's investigating itself. What you then find is those individuals who are undertaking those investigations, they tend to come from the dominant group with a particular mindset and perspective of what's control and restraint looks like. But then if you take that incident, that particular incident, from a perspective of someone who's in a minority position, their views may be very different. And that's one of the examples that I provided in chapter nine. You have an incident of control and restraint, which on the surface is a sanctioned form of controlling prisoners who are felt to be a risk to either themselves or the member of staff. But then you have individuals who are perceiving that particular type of control in a different way to the dominant group. So what this study shows is that it's important to take into account the diversity of experience, the diversity of perspective, and hopefully to encourage the organisation to think differently about the people that work there, but also some of the embedded structures that are there that seem to keep perpetuating, which then ends up marginalising individuals continuously make some individuals' experience of working in that organisation very painful in respect of the racial isolation, the discriminatory practice that might happen, and the microaggressions, and etc.
Yeah, and the next few questions that I have for you sort of focus around member or participants in your study that sort of stood out as we might view them as sort of focal participants, right? And the first person that you mentioned is Rosa. So who is Rosa, and what does her narrative sort of tell us about that process you were alluding to, that transitioning from the individual to a prison officer?
Well, Rosa was a prison officer, and she worked at a number of establishments. And she described in her interview, she'd been working for the organisation, I think, for 25 years. And she described her period of going to training. And what was particularly interesting about Rosa's, and I use the carceral space as a means to describe her experience, because she talked about having to be part of a race relations training session, which she doesn't actually say to me, I found it quite derogatory. And that's where the unconscious aspect of not wanting to own the pain that you go through. But she talks about how it affected her colleagues and how they took offense to this particular exercise that they had to do as part of the training. But in that same breath, she talks about her training as being a positive experience. She relates it to her school days, which again, I've understood that in a sense of she was looking at it from a positive period in her life of going to school. And in a sense, that's how the organization can sometimes infantile people in respect of trying to control them. She again talks about, and she gave a really good example about how gender and race and other identities just get undermined in an incident where she arrived to work late. And her senior officer chastised her for her lateness, never gave her an opportunity to explain why she was late. But she then says, I was never late again. So that incident and the way in which she was treated then affected her behaviour and her career up until the point of our interview. She also talked about how the incident of the control and restraint made her even more detached from the organization, because in the earlier chapter where she gives an example of violence and how she's introduced to the organization as a violent place, in which the metaphor of a scissors has gone missing, which means that's two knives and you have to walk with your back against the wall, those are the sort of subtle ways in which, in her account, she's showing how she was introduced to an environment that was violent, into an environment in which you have to protect yourself. Even though, if we think about the prison officer code, it's about supporting each other. But yet she was feeling, well, actually, in that subtle metaphor and in that sort of situation, I need to be protecting myself. And then that came to pass when she was supervising these prisoners during a cleaning duty that she had to do. And she says that, you know, I took meticulous notes because I wanted to make sure that I was getting it right. And then when I then was instructing these prisoners to fulfill this particular duty, I realized that the instructions I was given by my colleague was wrong. And then I basically, she felt vulnerable and it could have put her in a difficult position if she hadn't used her own common sense and made a judgment call. So here you've got Rosa, who enters the prison service nervous. She's been advised that it's a dangerous place. She's already suspicious because of what she's been told. And then it plays out in her interaction and in her observations and carrying out her duty. The unconscious or the fantasized part of the organization becomes real in the examples that she gives. So she provided a really rich account of prison work, from literally training all the way through to her actually working in various prisons as a prison officer.
Yeah, and I think that the next person that you mentioned in, you know, the following chapter was Lisa. So, and in Lisa's account, you kind of talk also about returning to the sort of psychodynamic or psychosocial aspects of prison work, and in particular, the Oedipal situation. So maybe going over sort of what that is and sort of how you're using it and what Lisa's narrative tells us about the prison.
I decided to use the sort of the Oedipal situation as an example to explain Lisa's relationship. Lisa was a manager, a diversity manager, and she explained her, or she described her relationship with her two white female managers, one who was directly line managing her and then the department's manager. The reason why I decided to use the sort of the Oedipal situation and the triangular relationship, because you have three individuals in a relationship that forms the triangle. The Oedipal situation talks about the relationship of the child or the young person, the child who resents the father because the father is seen as a threat or of someone that is taking the attention of the mother, who is the main object or the main desire of the child. So I use that situation because the examples that Lisa gave when she first joined the organization and she was looking for a mentor, and she had a positive view towards the department's manager, which she felt that her line manager, Jezebel, was preventing her from having that relationship or getting the support that she felt that she needed from the department's manager. So that's why I use that particular theory or framework to actually describe how there were three individuals. It wasn't about gender, because all three of them share the same gender, but there was a clear blurring between the racial aspect of Lisa being a black female and her white female counterparts, who had formed an allegiance which she felt was against her or means to control her or undermine the work that she was doing and her position as a manager in her own right. But her being so closely managed took away her autonomy to actually control the staff that she was given to fulfill a particular role. But also her experience played out in her role as diversity manager. She had been appointed to improve race relations in that particular prison, and she was finding it very difficult to get the staff on board to support her agenda. But yet she was also subject to those same race relations issues around the not necessarily discrimination, but the suspicion that comes about of being a different ethnic group to the majority group. And that comes out in her explanation about a particular task that she did where she needed, she'd borrowed some resources to do a particular event in the prison, and it got damaged while it was supposed to have come in. And it just showed how if individuals don't work together, then how a simple task of a delivery around to a prison can actually cause a lot of problems. But then also when you're thinking that you're not part of the group, so she didn't feel like she was a full part of that triangle relationship, she felt that her managers were conspiring against her, and that obviously made her feel very uncomfortable. And towards the end of that chapter, she actually talks about the dilemma and the tension that she felt in, on the one hand, wanting to organize an event for her manager leaving, but then she felt really emotionally exhausted and drained because she was, I guess, battling between wanting to do something and not wanting to do it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, moving on to the final sort of focal participant that you have was Lorna. And Lorna's narrative really talks about, and you talk about, you know, with and using her narrative, sort of the aspects of the group mentality in prison. So what was Lorna's narrative, and what does that tell us about that group mentality?
Well, Lorna was a senior manager, and she worked at the prison service head office. And she was in a role that was very high profile. She was a specialist. And in her, the reason why I use Beyond's theory around group mentality is because here you have a woman who is clearly competent in the role that she's doing. She's being line managed by a particular individual who has some reservations around the changing of his department in which Lorna works in. You have Lorna here who's describing her work ethics and her drive to do a really good job and working extra hours and just wanting to continue with the success of the organization, while she's got her manager who, I guess, in a sense, may have been apprehensive about changing the role of the organization from developing policy to becoming more operational, which would involve ensuring that things are being done at a prison level. The reason why I use Beyond's theory with group mentality is because she described three different areas. So she gave examples of her fight and flight, where initially she was determined to do really well and she was challenging the resistance that she was receiving from her senior managers. But then she gets to a point where she just wants to leave the work that she loved and the specialist area. In another example, she talked about a lady that comes in who again is a senior manager who she thought was there to help her, who was there to support her. But then she talks about, and this lady was a white female, and she talks about the fact that this person took her ideas and then sold them as their own. And then in the end ended up taking over Lorna's role and her position. And she felt very hurt about that because obviously she had invested a lot of trust into this woman who she felt basically took advantage of the situation and just used her, I guess, to progress her own career. And that's where she talks about the subtleties of racial difference, because she says that, you know, this is a white lady who's here. They brought her in to find out what was going on. They then gave her the resources that Lorna had been requesting, and actually gave these resources to this particular lady and had not given it to her or supported her to continue developing this particular intervention that she was introducing, bearing in mind that she was getting a lot of publicity from ministerial level across the organization. She'd got promoted in quite a short period of time, so she clearly showed how capable she was, but yet she was then she was then not given the resources to maintain that momentum, and then basically moved out into another role. So that's why I use the Beyonds group mentality, because it actually shows how a group can actually become dysfunctional, even though without even realizing that's becoming dysfunctional, because it was working well and they changed the dynamics by moving Lorna out rather than support Lorna in the role that she was doing. And the reason why I guess what I mentioned earlier, why I use the organizational psychodynamics, is because sometimes decisions are made that the individual who is the subject of that decision may not understand or be aware of. And then sometimes decisions are made that even the individuals who are making them may not necessarily know or understand the rationale behind it, because they are being influenced by something else, which in this situation, Lorna explains, it could be the fact that this woman shared the same race as the senior managers. And also she had been in the organization for a lot longer. So there was that sort of bond between those individuals. And that's where I spoke about culture, the culture of the organization. If you've got individuals that share the same race as individuals, or they've been in the service for a long time, or the same gender, then they will sometimes form a particular bond or unity that when you're not part of that group, you are automatically excluded without the person's even realizing that they're doing it, because they're doing it unconsciously.
So one of the things that really struck me when I was reading your book was, you know, at least in the United States, there has been a lot of talk around prison reform, and, you know, sort of the ways that folks talk about that is usually from either a sentencing point of view, or sort of, you know, reforming ways that, you know, ways that we do punish while we're in prison. But what your book sort of outlines is part of what we also need to look at are the people that are working within the prison, within that sort of organizational culture. So what do you think your book and your work and what you were able to uncover in these interviews tells us about sort of maybe a future of prison reform?
I think what this book tells us is that reform, it's all and well developing new strategies and plans and policies, but it's the people that work in the organization that are the ones that will either make something work and be successful or not. I guess I refer to those individuals as the gatekeepers. So we have similar strategies around prison reform over in the UK as well. We've got a particular drive at the moment, which is looking at the Lammy Review, which looked at the overrepresentation and high proportion of Black and ethnic minority offenders going through the whole criminal justice system, and the lack of Black and ethnic minority managers in senior levels throughout those various organizations. So we have similar reforms. What my book shows, and some of the conversations that I've been having, is that if you don't address those that I call the gatekeepers, so if you don't get these individuals on board in regards to making these changes, then the changes won't necessarily be successful. Also, in regards to making change involves a moment of uneasiness. It involves a shift in the way in which you think, feel, and relate to a particular situation. Prisons are, as I've said, are white male dominated organizations. The status quo is that white men manage the organization. They predominantly manage prisons themselves. It's going to be very hard for them to just say, okay, I'm going to make my board or my prison senior managers more diverse. They may have the good intentions that they want that to happen, but as we know, people tend to relate, form unity and bonds with people that look like them, sound like them, and have similar backgrounds to them. Until individuals accept this realization and are prepared to go through that emotional introjection of actually understanding, well, what does white superiority mean to me, and how am I going to share that superiority over whatever organization I work in, then in regards to race, things won't change. What will happen is that you may see a few token gestures to say, well, we are making changes, but sort of the long-term changes that we need for prisons to become more of a rehabilitative culture, as opposed to a culture that focuses on control and punish and protect. You won't see that substantial change. You will still continue to see an overrepresentation of Black and ethnic minority prisoners in prisons. You will continue to see a high churn of Black and ethnic minority employees in the organization who join and then leave within short periods of time. And you will still see very few Black and ethnic minority managers in senior positions who can then bring a diversity of thinking, perceptions, ways of working to the organization, because ultimately prisons are organizations that function because they are the same. They focus on a rigid system and structures that have been there, like I mentioned, for many, many years. So it'd be very difficult to just introduce a new reform and expect that to happen in actual establishments unless you address the gatekeepers.
Right. And I think that, you know, is really important and a great point. And why, you know, this book is really important, especially right now. And I know we've taken up a lot of your time today, so I only have a couple remaining questions. And this one might be a little bit of an overlap with this last question. But if you were to have folks read your book and sort of have one big takeaway from the book, one main idea that really sticks, what do you think that would be?
I think it will depend on the reader. I think if the readers are academics or professionals working in organizations in which, so for example, my initial purpose of even doing the whole PhD and writing this book is because I wanted to give a voice to Black women who worked in organizations where they may feel silenced. I also wanted to show that if you have a will and a drive to achieve something like this, you can do it. I was told at the very beginning of actually applying to do my PhD that I wouldn't be able to do it. And now I have a book that is focused on my PhD. So first of all, it would be encouraging individuals who may think I would like to do something like this, but not quite sure that they can, that they should follow their dreams and do it. Secondly, if it was for policymakers, so for example, within the prison service or in other large institutions, whether that's healthcare, whether that's civil service, whether that's transport, to actually take into account their staff's perspectives, use different means to actually understand what experience feels like. Large organizations tend to focus on collecting data and they treat employees as though they are numbers. Numbers don't tell you what it feels like to work in an organization. Numbers don't tell you how to make changes. All you can do with numbers really is quantify them. So I would encourage policymakers, researchers to think about other qualitative methods to actually understand the experience of individuals if that's what they want to do. I feel if you want to make changes that are actually worthwhile and are long attainable, and you want to bring people with you, then you have to take people's views on board. And you won't be able to get people's views on board if you're just counting numbers. So you need to take that time to actually interview people or share testimonies or complete exit interviews, but then do something with that information. And be prepared to actually, there's that saying about you don't really want to put your dirty laundry in public, but be prepared to actually receive negative feedback and then use that negative feedback in a positive way to make work environments more diverse, more inclusive, and to allow people to feel more part of the organization and share the organization's identity, as opposed to being places where people will come to work and then don't feel part of it, so actually feel isolated but are just doing a job. So I think it depends on the type of reader. I'm hoping that the book actually will help people to just think about prison work as not just being white, male, burly, ex-military employees, but actually prison work and the people that work in prisons are very diverse and they come from very different backgrounds and they have very different experiences. I guess that's the main thing that I'd want everyone to take from it, that it's not only white men that work in prisons, but Black women work in prisons too.
Right. And I think, you know, when you talk about, you know, if organizations want to make change and listening to their employees and using these more qualitative methods, I mean, I think in certain ways, the ways that we see this lack of change comes, it may come from that overemphasis or maybe, you know, at times sort of obsession that folks have and policymakers have around the quantitative, right? You're not able to get sort of this holistic picture of your organization. And I think your book does an excellent job at pointing out, you know, what can be uncovered when looking at organizations in a different way. And, you know, just as our final question today, if folks listen to this conversation and they're really, you know, interested and they want to learn more, or they're just interested in sort of, you know, the readings that got you to think about these problems in this way, what are three book recommendations that you could get of our audience today?
I would suggest the first book that actually gave me the momentum and drive to actually feel that my experience as a Black woman was valid was in reading Patricia Hill's Feminist Thought book. That really opened my eyes to actually think that Black women do have a particular experience that is worth researching and analysing and putting out there. If individuals wanted to know more about, I guess, UK prisons and actually compare my approach to some of the books that have been written on occupational work in prisons, then the Alison Liebling's Prison Officer book would be a good starting point to actually have a look at. Well, what are the type of people that work in prisons from the perspective of that research in comparison to my book that presents Black women as being the focal point? So the third one is a difficult one, but I guess it would probably be a selection of Bell Hooks's books. Again, they are from that, I guess, Black feminist perspective, but those books kind of give you a fuller picture of what it means to be Black, female, and have other different types of identities, and how we negotiate from the perspective of being marginalized to actually overcome some of the barriers as Black women that we may face, whether that's in work or in our personal lives or in academia. But I guess off the top of my head, it would be those three authors' work.
Yeah, and I would agree that those are excellent recommendations. At least I have read two of those, so I can vouch for two of those very excellent reads. And I just want to encourage everyone listening to check out Dr. Marsha Morgan's book, Black Women Prison Employees, The Intersectionality of Gender and Race. Dr. Morgan, thanks so much for joining us today on the New Books Network.
Thank you.